In the name of the Father, and the Son, and God's Holy Spirit, one God. Amen. A number of years ago now, actually when I was interning at a Presbyterian church in Connecticut, there was a young man in that congregation who went off to one of the big state universities. And while he was there, he encountered this very fervent, conservative, religious group. And as a result of that encounter, I think he had his first real religious experience in his life. Prior to that, I would say his spiritual journey had been largely secondhand. You know, the faith of his parents and the congregation and what they did. But all of a sudden, God became very real to this young man. And not surprisingly, therefore, he became a very exuberant witness. Well, that first Christmas break when he was home, he made an appointment with his home pastor to share this experience. But then he went on to sort of criticize the pastor. He said, "Why did I never hear any of this from any of your sermons when I was growing up?" Well, I mean, the pastor tried not to take that personally. He had heard things like that before. I mean, this young man just didn't realize that prior to that time, he hadn't been ready to hear the gospel in the same way. So even though, in a sense, he was being rejected by this young man, he tried not to return the favor. And that patience and that wisdom really bore fruit the following summer, when once again the young man was home and he made another appointment with the pastor, this time very confused. He said, "The group that I am now a member of has as its slogan, 'One Way.' We teach that there is a single plan of salvation. But to be honest, I've been reading the Bible a little myself recently, and I cannot find this one way. Jesus seems to say different things to different people. For example, when the prominent leader Nicodemus comes to him in the nighttime and says, 'What do I need to do to be saved?' Jesus tells him, 'You need to be born again.' But when another young man, a rich young ruler, comes to him asking a very similar question, he doesn't say anything about being born again. He tells him, 'You need to sell everything that you have and give it to the poor.' The woman at the well comes to him, and she also is obviously looking to go deeper in her life, but nothing about being born again. He doesn't tell her to sell anything. He tells her to drink of the living water that he can offer her. Where is the one way?" he said. "Jesus seems to be inconsistent." Well, the pastor, I think, again, very wisely affirmed this young man for taking his faith so seriously, which, let's face it, always involves asking some tough questions. And he acknowledged that sometimes it seems like Jesus speaks in different voices to different people. However, he said, "If you will look deeply under the surface of each of these episodes, it may be that there is a connecting theme." Jesus never used the term plan of salvation, but he did base his whole life on one fundamental principle. And it is our Old Testament lesson this morning. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." You see, said the pastor, in every situation that you have cited, Jesus is applying that principle to the particular situation that he is confronting. He said, "No doctor," Cindy would know this, "no doctor prescribes the same medication for every individual patient. Rather, she assesses what is going on and then she prescribes the remedy accordingly." And that's precisely what Jesus is doing in every one of these examples. For example, if you would have asked Nicodemus, what do you value the most in life? There's a good chance he would have said, well, I was born of Jewish parents. I'm a child of Abraham, one of God's chosen people. And of course, that is not an unusual idolatry. There are people in every generation and in every nation who have thought that their ancestry and their race is the be-all, end-all of who they are. And what Jesus is saying to Nicodemus is that he needs to re-perceive his birth. He needs to recognize that he is first and foremost a child of God rather than a child of Jewish parents. However, for the rich young ruler, that was just not the shape of his idolatry. Rather, he had learned to put his trust in his material things. If you would have asked him, what do you depend on most when the chips are down? If he was honest, he would say, I depend on what my money can do for me. And Jesus saw that the remedy for his particular idolatry involved changing the way he felt about his things. Not necessarily regarding them as evil. Money is not poison. Otherwise, Jesus would never have told him to go and give it to others. But rather to stop looking at it as the end for which he lived and begin to look at it as the means by which he lived and to put his money at the service of others, which is what it was intended for. And then the woman at the well, the Samaritan who comes and is told to take living water, Jesus is suggesting to her that she needed to see the constant in life that was beneath all of the fluxes, all of the changes that come along. Now, to be honest, for many years, I assumed that this woman's idolatry was that of physical pleasure. When Jesus says to her, you've had five husbands, and the guy that you're living with now is not your husband, I assumed this was all about physical pleasure. This woman knows nothing about commitment. And then somewhere along the way, I read this article that completely changed my understanding of her, because it reminded me that no woman in first century Palestine would have been able to get a divorce by her own initiative. That was something only men could do. And therefore, the article suggested that what we have here is a woman of enormous grief. She has either had five husbands to die on her, or she has had five husbands leave her, or some combination of those two. But here is a person who has lost and lost and lost. And therefore, she must have begun to despair that there was anything in life that could be constant, anything that she could really count on. And so Jesus says to her, just as you come to this well and you drink, but then a few hours later you are thirsty again, so your fear is that there is nothing lasting in life, nothing that you can depend on. And you need to let go of that despair and drink of this living water, that is the love that God has for you and always will. You remember what God said to Jesus in his baptism, you are the beloved. And you need to take that deeper and deeper into your heart. But you see, underneath each of these encounters, there is this one unifying theme. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Which is really just a retelling of the first commandment. That Jesus made the core of his ministry. He spent more of his time on that first commandment than all of the other nine put together. And I think the reason that Jesus did that is because the vision of reality that comes to us in those few words is utterly basic in all of our spiritual journeys. I had a seminary professor who never tired of telling us, when it comes to life, there are really only two forms of reality. On the one hand, there is the uncreated, that which has life in itself, the source of everything that is. And on the other hand is the created, that which draws its life from the uncreated source. He said everything but God belongs on the created side. Nothing but God belongs on the uncreated side. To be created, literally in English, means to hang like a chandelier, to be held in place by something else. And the real secret of life is to learn to regard God as the ultimate that God is, and not make the mistake of taking anything on the created side and putting it in its place. And unfortunately, that means even the best of things, which is where it gets so tricky, right? No relationship with a spouse or a partner or a child or a grandchild, my first grandchild. No thing, not a car, not even an ancient Ford Mustang or a brand new F-150. No house. We just remodeled the kitchen in the house we've moved into. It's beautiful. Not even that. No institution, not a nation, or a church, or the church, can ultimately satisfy our deepest needs. Nothing on the created side. Now, I realize that words like idolatry, commandments like "you shall have no other gods before me," they sound archaic. I mean, we just don't talk that way anymore. But I would suggest to you that this is an important part of every one of our spiritual journeys. And that is true of us individually as it is collectively. Over the Christmas holidays, somebody asked me to read an article by Andrew Sullivan, the sometimes controversial Lincoln Republican. And it was about the decline of Christianity in our country. I suppose it could just as easily have been about the decline of religion in general. You know, the fastest growing religious group in our country is nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And so Sullivan is asking the question, so what is filling that void now in our culture? And he probably could have talked about any number of things, but he pointed to two things that he said belong up at the top of the list. One of those is an unbridled materialism. It is no accident that the prosperity gospel has moved from sideline to mainline in our culture, with its false promise that if only we are faithful, God will make us rich. Something that the Jesus who walks the pages of the New Testament would never have said. The other thing he pointed to is our politics, which, let's face it, have taken on a kind of religious fervor as never before, which is why it is next to impossible to have a conversation with someone that we disagree with in a reasonable way. And why words like compromise, such an essential part of a democracy, have now become passé. And people who advocate it for it seem weak and ineffective. And the consequences are dire. Because Jesus did say, a house divided against itself cannot stand. I suppose we have all known people who at some point have hitched their wagon to something or to someone, only to discover in the long run that it cannot fully satisfy their ultimate needs. I call it the cotton candy experience. Do you remember the first time you ever tasted that delectable sticky stuff? I was 6 years old at a church bazaar. I saw it, and it was pink in one of those little machines that they made it in. And I asked my mother if I could have it. And I still remember that first bite, the most exquisite sweetness I had ever tasted in all of my vast 6 years. And just as I went to get my mouth around it and really savor it, lo and behold, it disappeared into air. And so a second bite, and again, another quick sensation, but then that emptiness. You see, whenever we try to get from this side of the line, what we can only get from this side, we are always setting ourselves up for cotton candy. Because the secret of the biblical vision, and the reason that Jesus spent so much more of his time on that than all the other nine put together, is that there really is only one true God. One of my friends from seminary, Steve, went to serve a little church in Appalachia. And there were all kinds of stories that came out of the traditions of those Appalachian folk. But the one that Steve liked to tell the most was about this new pastor who had come to town for the first time. And this was at the turn of the 20th century. So he arrived in the typical mode of transportation for that, which you can remember is one of those little buggies, you know, the ones with the little wheels in the front and the big wheels in the back, and there's a single horse that is pulling it. And so he came in the afternoon and he met with some of the church leadership. And then that evening, they had their first worship service together. Well, if you know anything about these kind of communities, you know there are always folk who sort of hang out around the church, but they never really come into the church. And so a couple of those folks decided they would see what kind of sense of humor the new pastor had. And so they backed his buggy up behind a couple of trees, and they switched the wheels. They put the big wheels where the little ones were supposed to be and the little ones where the big ones are supposed to be, and then they put it back where it had come from. Well, that evening, of course, it's dark when the service ended, and the pastor greeted everybody, and one of the deacons had invited him to come and to spend the night at his house that first night, which he did. The next morning, the deacon saw the preacher standing out in his front yard looking down in the direction of the church with this very puzzled look on his face. And so he said to him, "What's the matter?" And the preacher said, "Well, I came out here this morning to look at that steep hill that I came up last night." He said, "I think it was the steepest hill I've ever been on. I thought my horse was really going to lose his footing." The deacon said, "Well, that's funny. You know, the land between here and the church is really pretty level." And they were both confused until they went out into the barn. And there in the light of day, they saw what had been done. Well, they did have a good laugh. But then the new preacher said, "You know, there's a lesson to be learned from this. Every time you get the big wheels in life where the little wheels are supposed to be, and the little ones where the big ones are supposed to be, life becomes an uphill climb." He said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give will never thirst. Hear, O church, the Lord is our God. The Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, and all of your might."